This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson visiting New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. We often have to change the Friday News Roundup hours before the program airs to account for breaking news. Today was no different, with a story we figured we'd better include, especially considering where we are.
One ball, one strike. Kimbrel deals in the air, deep left field, hit well. Benintendi on the run. He's got it! And the Boston Red Sox are headed to the World Series!
Sporting goods stores started selling Red Sox commemorative shirts almost as soon as Boston beat the defending champion Astros. Houston lost its bid to return to the World Series after the Red Sox won last night 4-1. The series starts in Boston on Tuesday against either the LA Dodgers or the Milwaukee Brewers. At the moment, the Dodgers lead their series 3-2. Now, maybe you are a fan of none of these teams, but considering how serious the midterms are, you can't begrudge folks for wanting a bit of a break from the news. We will get to this week's big stories, though, including the elections in New Hampshire and nationwide, the continuing recovery effort after Hurricane Michael, and alarming new projections for the U.S. deficit. Considering how big all those stories are, is it any wonder we started with the run for the pennant? Joining us here at New Hampshire Public Radio is its senior political correspondent, Josh Rogers. Josh, welcome to 1A.
Good to be here.
Back in our Washington studio is Alexandra Jaffe, a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Alexandra, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Franco Ordonez is a White House correspondent for McClatchy. Franco, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Let's begin with politics and the run-up to the midterms, starting in Montana, where President Trump campaigned last night, and he made some comments that seemed to praise violence against journalists. He was speaking to a crowd of supporters when the president cheered Montana Representative Greg Gianforte for assaulting a reporter back in May. Here's what the president said.
Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind of...
The president went on to say that he had initially worried that the assault would tank Gianforte's campaign, but said he then remembered, quote, "This is Montana. It might help him, and it did," unquote. Representative Gianforte pled guilty to misdemeanor assault last year after body slamming Ben Jacobs, a reporter for The Guardian. A judge sentenced him to 180 days deferred sentence, 40 hours of community service, 20 hours of anger management, and a fine of $300. Now, Franco Ordonez, I wonder if I could start with you. The president's comments come as his administration deals with what is increasingly looking like the murder, the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the columnist from The Washington Post. The president has a history of trash-talking the press, to put it mildly. Cheering on somebody body-slamming a reporter, typically we'd say that's over the line, but it's not really out of character for this president, is it?
No, it's not at all, and it is putting it mildly. You know, this is unfortunately a political strategy of the president. I mean, we spoke to Corey Lewandowski, one of his lead campaign guys during the campaign, who told us that, look, President Trump, one of his most effective political strategies is creating a foil to run against, and the media is the opposition party, as he and Steve Bannon have often said, and this is a strategy, and obviously, clearly, it works for his base. You saw the applause at the rally, and I've been on rallies as well and seen this is like one of two of the biggest applause lines after immigration. Attacking the media always gets quite a bit of hoopla.
One of the other critiques, Alexandra Jaffe, of the media is that we tend to run after shiny objects, the kind of outrage of the day. The president also returned to mocking Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, saying it was no longer appropriate to refer to her as Pocahontas now that Senator Warren has taken a DNA test to substantiate her Native American ancestry, something we discussed on this program earlier this week. Now, Senator Warren is seen as a possible presidential candidate in 2020. This week, she got a lot of flack from the left and the right for publicizing the test, claiming that she has some Native American blood. I wonder what context we should put all of this in, Alexandra. I mean, are we chasing a series of shiny objects here, or is there something more substantive to all of this?
I mean, you're right to call it a shiny object, but it's hard not to say that she, you know, didn't walk into that herself. That was part of the criticism from the left, was why did you even wade into this debate and sort of elevate it by trying to prove it wrong? Up until now, Donald Trump had looked pretty bad by using these racial slurs against her, essentially. And because she went out and did this DNA test and released it and sort of dignified it with a response, it elevates the discussion beyond what it had to be. And so some of the blame is on her for starting that conversation when she didn't need to necessarily.
Josh Rogers, we're going to talk more about New Hampshire politics a little later in the program. But do folks here in the Granite State care about all of this kind of like bickering, the kind of schoolyard politics, the, oh, I'm glad he body slammed the guy, and oh, calling her Pocahontas? Like, there's a lot of other stuff going on in New Hampshire. How much do you feel like these kinds of, we'll call them shiny objects for now, really matter to voters here in New Hampshire?
Well, I think they matter as much as many other things. Donald Trump is looking to shore up his base here on behalf of Republicans running. You know, this is certainly in keeping with the way he ran away with the New Hampshire primary. This is really his first, the place where he first won. There's no reason for him to believe that this won't be effective. And, you know, for consumers of talk radio in the region, the back and forth over Elizabeth Warren's ancestry has been standard fare now for years.
And for actually, as I think of that, I wonder if, from your perspective, Josh, it's too reductive to say that voters are focused either on these kind of red meat political issues or on more substantive local issues. I assume it's a little more both and, that voters here can hold both of those things in their heads at the same time?
Well, I think they can hold both, but it's hard to, one thing I've been trying to fathom is the degree to which Donald Trump leaves space for other things to be held in one's mind. You talk to voters who are interested in the outcomes of the fall elections, and you know, they will tell you that the torrent of news out of Washington makes it hard to really pay attention to local issues. And that's something that candidates are struggling with as well. And as far as Elizabeth Warren goes, you know, there are local indications that she's, you know, building a campaign organization in wait up here. She has staffers working up here. And certainly Democrats I've talked to about her decision to announce the outcome of this DNA test, you know, a bunch of them said, I wish she would have waited till after the midterms. And, you know, there are those who would make the broader point that, you know, identity is a more social question than genetic. You know, why she wanted to go there is something that nobody I've talked to here has a good idea about.
We did have a conversation this Wednesday about that very thing. Also, NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates had a story about what is identity, quite in that context. We'll talk more about what voters here in New Hampshire are thinking in the run-up to the midterms as we continue the roundup with Josh Rogers, senior political correspondent with New Hampshire Public Radio, Alexandra Jaffe, correspondent with Vice News Tonight on HBO, and McClatchy White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Let's shift gears to Georgia, where early voting got underway this week. The governor's race there has been very closely watched. Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate, would become Georgia's first black female governor if she wins. The Republican candidate, Brian Kemp, is currently Georgia's Secretary of State. He's been under fire after the Associated Press reported that a recent purge of the voter rolls disproportionately affected black voters. Also, APM reports from American Public Media put a number to how many voters have been purged recently. It's about 107,000. I wonder, Franco, what the impact of all of this is. Kemp, as the Secretary of State, oversees elections in Georgia. He's also in an election in Georgia. And he's pushed back, saying everyone whose registration was suspended can still cast a ballot. I wonder what context we put this in, Franco.
It's a massive issue. I mean, here, this could be the closest race in recent history. It's dogged by these allegations of voters being cut from the rolls, mostly talk about keeping more than 50,000 mostly black residents off the rolls. You know, the Kemp says that he can be impartial, and he points to other secretaries of state who have overseen elections. But, you know, the sources that we have spoken to, and we've covered this, say that, look, this is just a matter of common sense. It is so close. It is so important that he should be considered recusing himself from overseeing this such a critical election. There's too much at stake. But he seems to be fighting fighting that, and we'll see what happens. This is an issue that we will continue to see for the next several weeks.
And just to be clear, Stacey Abrams will become America's first black female governor, not just Georgia's first if she wins. Alexandra, I know we have to pause momentarily, but this race seems to be pretty close. What happens if this comes down to a few hundred votes? Then you've got the official who oversees elections trying to, I presume, keep some reasonable distance in determining whether he wins the election he is in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a legal fight that could go on for weeks if we're at the point where it's close enough that we're seeing a recount. And I was speaking with some sort of election protection officials yesterday who said that Georgia is their top priority. They're training, you know, hundreds of lawyers to be on the ground in that state, watching the polls, making sure that nothing happens on sort of election day. And then beyond, they are preparing for a protracted fight over that race because, you know, it's expected to come down to a couple hundred votes.
Let me get to a few of your comments, including some of you who are commenting about this Elizabeth Warren story. Martin writes, do you think Native American voters will vote Republican and support Trump because of this? Not likely. Andy writes, I relish anything that makes Trump angry or makes him look bad, and I was very happy that Warren released this DNA result. He showed his immaturity and lack of decorum once again when he simply replied, who cares, at hearing this story. Bait him endlessly and bring him out of his hole for all the world to see. That's my desire. Alexandra, I wonder if you could respond to Andy's comment, this idea of baiting the president and kind of showing him for what he really is.
I mean, that was tried over and over again in the 2016 election, and it didn't end up working. I think when you engage with Trump in some of these arguments, that's what fires up his base. And that's what's been his success in the past. That's what could help Republicans sort of succeed in the midterms. And it's a dangerous strategy for Democrats in 2020. I think taking the high road still seems to be the best tactic, but we'll see how things play out.
Go ahead, Franco.
It's a very dangerous strategy. I mean, I just want to, you know, add to what Alexandra was saying. I mean, look, this is what happened in 2016. Every time, during the primaries and the Republicans, every time Rubio, Jeb Bush, all of them tried to take Trump on in his, you know, neck of the woods, kind of playing in this dirty water, Trump just kind of took him out. And I think it's very dangerous for Democrats to try to play in those waters. And that's in many ways why Trump continues to be so powerful, particularly in the Republican Party, because so many of his own party members, leaders, are afraid to take him on because he's so good at this stuff.
Josh?
Well, if you look at the way in which, a parochial entity like the New Hampshire Democratic Party is trying to stoke enthusiasm for its base coming up to the elections, I found it telling that the guests that they've brought up, typically these would be people, you know, eyeing presidential runs for big fundraisers and big events to rally behind candidates, have been, you know, Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti and Alec Baldwin. And we haven't yet seen, I mean, typically the more traditional candidates would start arriving in preparation for 2020 after the midterms, but the people who've drawn the most attention have been the people who've cast themselves as Trump antagonists, and the coffers of the local Democratic Party would tell you that that's been good for them. So, you know, the midterms have, up here at least, are shaping up as sort of an all against all on the question of Trump.
Another politician who at one point was an antagonist of Donald Trump on the campaign trail was Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. He is running for his seat again, and this week he debated his Democratic challenger, Beto O'Rourke. People are pretty closely watching this race because it could help decide which party controls the Senate because the margin of control is so tight. Ted Cruz is ahead in the polls at the moment, but as we said, the race is still pretty tight, and O'Rourke came out swinging in the debate. He even used President Trump's nickname for Ted Cruz from the 2016 election, calling him Lion Ted. At one point, Franco Ordonez, what sense do we have of how the candidates came out of that debate?
I think this is one of the most fascinating races. It's been the most fascinating race probably throughout the terms, and it's going to continue to be as it goes down to the wire. this was always going to be a long shot for Beto O'Rourke. He tried to come across early on. He, you know, tried not to say too much about Cruz and Trump, and you know, but he's been dropping in the polls, and he's had to take a new tack, using this language of Lion Ted, attacking him about saying that Cruz is only for Cruz, pointing out how many communities he's visited in Iowa, but not in Texas. It's been a major shift in tone for O'Rourke, but it's also been something that clearly he's been uncomfortable with. Just yesterday during the town hall, he said he perhaps went a little bit too far in the heat of the moment, and this is not necessarily something that he wants, you know, kind of the tone that he wants to take in his campaign. Whether it'll work, we'll see. But, you know, there's a lot of hope for Beto O'Rourke. Some hope is, like, if he can actually take this tackle, that maybe he could be a 2020 candidate. But that seems like another ballgame.
Yeah, Alexandra, I was going to ask you whether or not, or what your read was on whether this could work. I mean, I wonder if this debate gives us any more insight into whether a rather progressive Democrat like O'Rourke has a chance in a state like Texas, who's, you know, whose governor, both senators, you know, reliably conservative Republicans. Does this give us a sense of whether he moved the needle at all?
I mean, broadly, we have to be careful not to overemphasize debates in the midterms. Typically, you know, not that many voters watch them. Sometimes undecided voters do. But unless there's a major gaffe, they typically don't move the needle that significantly. And right now, I think the polling average shows that Ted Cruz is up by about 7 points, which on election day, if Texas votes the way it typically does, is enough. I also think an undercovered aspect of this race is the fact that Texas does straight ticket voting. You can go and mark a box for Republicans. And the strength of the Republican Party overall, the strength of Governor Greg Abbott, for instance, who's running, you know, against a Democrat that has been polling in the 30s, seems to be enough to carry Ted Cruz over the finish line, even if Beto O'Rourke has been able to keep him to single digits.
I just want to make sure we're clear on what you said, Alexandra. In Texas, you can just mark a box at the top of the ballot that says Republican, and it automatically counts that vote as counting for all the Republicans on the ticket?
Yep. You can basically vote for every Republican all at once. This is the last election that they'll be doing straight ticket voting. After that, it won't be as easy.
Well, fundraising reports from the third quarter of the year were due this week to the Federal Election Commission. They were due on Monday, and the results look pretty good for Democrats in House races, at least just in terms of the dollars and cents of it. Democrats are dominating fundraising in House seat races. The Democratic challengers outraised 92 Republican incumbents. More than 60 Democratic candidates raised more than $1 million that quarter. In the Senate, Democrats are also outraising Republicans. Beto O'Rourke raised $38 million in the third quarter. Ted Cruz raised just over $10 million. According to an analysis by 538, the Democrats' ability to outspend in Senate races has not correlated with a bump in the polls as it has in House races. Also glad to hear from some of you about the president on the campaign trail, including in Texas. Karen tweeted, "Trump is coming to Houston next Monday to rally for Ted Cruz. Monday is also the first day for early voting in Texas." Let's shift gears and head to Florida, where the after effects of Hurricane Michael continue to be felt and seen. The Weather Channel reports the death toll at least 35 people, with fatalities spread from Florida all the way up to Virginia. Now, those death toll figures are bad enough. But, Franco, what's our sense of how the recovery effort is going, particularly the effort to find people who've been missing?
Yeah, there's still people missing. There's still people who are trying to pick up their lives. You know, I think the town of Mexico Beach has not reported, given any numbers of how many people are missing. But there is talk of that it could likely be in the hundreds. I mean, this was a massive storm, talking about one of the biggest storms, the top three, perhaps by some accounts, that, you know, had made landfall that would make it bigger than Katrina. This has been a huge effort. Many people still do not, thousands still don't have phone service. And people are expecting, as phone service is restored and more roads are cleared and you're able to get more to people, that they're expecting the death toll to continue to rise.
Well, yeah, and Alexandra, the other big issue is when people can actually start to rebuild. I mean, it's fascinating and terrifying, horrifying at the same time, to look at some of the early drone camera pictures.
Yeah,
from where Hurricane Michael came ashore, from where it made landfall. you can almost tell which homes were built up to the latest building codes and which homes were not, because the homes that were up to codes were there and the homes that weren't were gone. And I wonder at what point the rebuilding effort is right now. Is there any expectation on when people could start to rebuild?
I was actually in North Carolina for the previous hurricane there, and they were saying, you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 to 24 months, people would still be in shelters waiting to rebuild, and that was just flooding. So there's got to be a lot of debris removal, like you said, with some of those aerial photos. There's a lot of destruction there. But I do think we don't talk enough about the long-term effects of these hurricanes. We're actually heading down to Florida this weekend to speak with folks in the Keys about the effect of Hurricane Irma. Down there, suicide rates have actually spiked because people have had so much trouble sort of getting back control and reestablishing their lives after the damage done by that hurricane. So it's not even just the rebuild, it's months and years after that damage does continue for these communities.
With regards to reestablishing their lives, Franco, what's our sense in terms of the kind of support that folks who were hit by Hurricane Michael are getting from their local governments, from FEMA? Do we get the sense that that's going well, or is there still a bit to be desired?
I mean, I think there's always going to be a bit to be desired. Certainly, this administration has come under fire for its responses to hurricanes, particularly recent hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico and South Florida. You know, they certainly made a big effort to change that and to come and meet better expectations in the most previous hurricane. I think that attention, they were able to take some of that attention away, but you know, also just in the nature of our news cycle today, there's so much news happening every day that there's some new news story that's happening that's kind of taking some of that attention away. So I'm not sure the national attention is as high on the FEMA recovery effort as before, but certainly there's no question that more support would be enjoyed.
Let's shift gears to a different kind of storm, a Twitter storm from the president this week on immigration. On Wednesday, the president exhorted Republicans to make immigration a key issue for the midterm elections. Josh Rogers, I'm interested in your take on New Hampshire, not just New Hampshire, but particularly New Hampshire, and how big a deal immigration is in the midterms. Are people talking about it? Is it one issue among many? Where does it stand?
I think it's one issue among many. It is one that has been potent for Republicans in this state. I can think back to, you know, when John McCain campaigned up here and talked about immigration reform, and you would sometimes have people leave the room. Donald Trump certainly rode that. We're very far from we're close to the Canadian border, we're quite far from Mexico. But it is something that Republicans are talking about. One thing that surprised me, though, is that the limited degree to which congressional candidates, Republicans, have been talking about it. If a voter brings it up, they will say they're generally supportive of the president and they believe, you know, we need to have a wall on the border and pretty much leave it there. It's hard to know how much Donald Trump can envision running for election in any other mode than the one he's chosen. And, you know, we'll see where that ends up. As far as voters go, conservative voters will tell you they're concerned about it, but it is not foremost in people's minds here.
Alexandra, I wonder what your sense is of whether or not immigration is the kind of issue that fires up, you know, Republicans to kind of mitigate what some people are calling a Democratic blue wave, whether it fuels Democratic support, whether it has a little bit of a benefit for both. I mean, who gets the most political bang for the buck by focusing on immigration?
Well, I spoke with a couple of Republican strategists working on House and Senate races this week who said that at this point, it's more of an advantage for Republicans because Democrats have overstepped in talking about abolish ICE. And to the extent to which, you know, President Trump and other Republicans can make that the brand of the Democratic Party, which we've been hearing that debate in within the sort of 2020 field, they believe that they can turn immigration into an advantage for Republicans and to sort of fire up the Republican base again. So at this point, it seems like they think that it's a win. And while we've seen in many polls that Hispanic voters generally are not as enthusiastic about the midterms and maybe not as excited to turn out for Democrats as Democrats would expect, I don't know that there's any concern necessarily for, or any risk rather, for Republicans to start talking about this issue.
Josh Rogers, the president, tweeted again with regards to immigration yesterday. He threatened to use the military in an effort to stem the tide of immigration into the U.S. Specifically, he was referring to a caravan of about 2,000 migrants that are headed to the U.S.-Mexico border, pretty much walking to the U.S.-Mexico border. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What nations did he threaten? Why? And whether that is even within the purview of the military?
I'm sorry, Franco.
Would you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a caravan of thousands. This has been done before. It's actually been done over the years. Based comes out of Honduras, but the countries, most of these migrants who are involved come from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They come to they make the trek to the United States. Their purpose is to bring attention to the plight of migrants, but also to come to the United States and to seek relief. Some apply for asylum. There's no question some will try to get into the country illegally. Others will kind of shrink, drop off on the way, trying to get opportunities in Mexico, for example. It is a massive issue. It is a massive issue for the president right now. He is completely jumped on this issue, trying to, you know, stir up emotion, stir up concern. This is obviously a 2016 issue as well. He used immigration as one of his signature issues, if not the signature issue, to take him to office. And this caravan is being used in that sense of saying, look, these tweets that he did yesterday blaming Democrats, blaming open borders, to the Democrats that I have spoke to, they see this as largely a political move to try to steer responsibility away from his own policies, because of some of the policies that was talked about just a minute ago have not been successful in clamping down on some of the migration. Take family separation policy that really blew up in his face, trying to cut down on the border. And the reality is we are seeing we're back to kind of record number of migration coming to the border.
The defense secretary did authorize deploying 4,000 National Guard troops along the border. I wonder what we make of that, whether it was kind of a deployment with the hopes that the governors would refuse to deploy these troops. I mean, what was behind that?
I mean, as Franco noted, it's a bit of a political play. It sort of backs up Trump's promise with at least an attempted action. But the question is, will that do anything? Will that change anything? And as Franco mentioned, even though the Trump administration has implemented stronger immigration policies, these border crossings are still coming and folks are still attempting to enter the country. So at the end of the day, it seems like more of sort of a PR move or a move to back up the president rather than anything that'll have an effect.
Josh Rogers, let's talk New Hampshire for a little while. There are two congressional races underway. There are two districts in New Hampshire. The race in District 1 will be historic, kind of no matter who wins, because either the Democrat, Chris Pappas, would become the state's first openly gay member of Congress. His Republican opponent, Eddie Edwards, would be the first black House member from New Hampshire. Tell us a bit more about the first congressional district. As I understand it, it's a swing district that Donald Trump carried in 2016, right?
Absolutely. It's been trading hands party to party from 2008, the GOP winning in midterm years, Democrats winning in presidential years. It's now held by Carol Shea Porter, a fairly liberal Democrat who's retiring. In Pappas and Edwards, you have people who are running really within the mainstream of their parties. Pappas has been serving in various elective offices for a long time. He's in his late 30s. His family owns a very popular restaurant in Manchester, often a stop for presidential candidates. He comes from Manchester, which is a town where even the Democrats have historically been a little bit more conservative than in other parts of the state, particularly on fiscal matters. Eddie Edwards is somebody who has a background in law enforcement. He was in the Navy. He at one time led the state's enforcement division of its liquor commission. In New Hampshire, we have those big highway liquor stores. Liquor's controlled by the state. That was a fairly big job. He ran the enforcement division, and he's been a police chief. They're pretty much keeping to well within the norms of their party. Eddie Edwards has, you know, embraced Donald Trump. He had Rudy Giuliani up here campaigning with him. And he's in some ways trying to cast Chris Pappas as, you know, part of some sort of resistance movement. It's this thing we've obviously seen nationally. Right. Chris Pappas is, you know, hardly a radical guy, family run restaurant, worked for Joe Lieberman when he ran for president. This race, though, is one where the seat can go either way, and both parties believe they have a shot.
There's also a gubernatorial race underway here. The Republican governor, Chris Sununu, faces Democrat Molly Kelly. She is one of 15 women running for governor across the country, which is an unprecedented number. The latest fundraising numbers that came out this week show that Kelly, the Democrat, has outraised Sununu, the incumbent Republican, 3-1. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York came to Concord yesterday to help campaign for Kelly. They met with employees of the Granite State Candy Shop, and they discussed paid family leave. I'm interested in where this issue sits in terms of all the issues New Hampshire voters are considering, but here's part of what happened with Kirsten Gillibrand's visit. Listen.
It's going to help families be happier and healthier. It's going to help people be more productive at work. And so it's a win-win.
Yes. Everywhere I go in the state, I hear about the need for paid family medical leave and how important it is for people to be able to have the choices in their life, to be able to work hard where they're working, but then to be able to spend time with the people they love the most when they're needed the most.
That was Molly Kelly you heard at the end. Senator Gillibrand was at the beginning. Tell us a bit more about Molly Kelly. Is this paid family leave issue a big one for her based on her political background, her personal background?
Well, it's been a huge issue for her. Whether it is for voters is an interesting test. I mean, she's been running pretty much exclusively on this issue. It's a challenge to somebody covering this race, how many stories one can write about paid family leave. My understanding is Democrats have polling that suggests that Governor Sununu is vulnerable on this issue. He was on the record supporting a paid family leave bill that didn't make it through the legislature, in part because he came out against it at the last minute for fear that a payroll deduction amounted to an income tax, which, you know, is a real kind of fighting words here in New Hampshire where there's no income tax. The Democrats believe this is an issue that works for Molly Kelly by dint of her background. At one point, she was a single mother with three kids who worked her way through college, and that, you know, Chris Sununu, son of a governor, brother of a U.S. senator, doesn't understand the stresses and strains that many working people face. And, you know, it does get it. New Hampshire has kind of a bifurcated economy, boom times for people of the upper income. We have budget surpluses and tax collections are up, but, you know, the wage growth for people at the lower end of the scale has not been great. And this is an issue that for Democrats, they feel that it kind of hits a lot of boxes and may help mobilize women, which are, you know, key constituent anywhere, but particularly here in New Hampshire.
How close is this governor's race?
Well, Sununu should win. We have 2-year terms here. No governor has been tossed after one term since 2004, and prior to that, it had been a century. So it's pretty rare that a governor doesn't get a second term, absent being a disaster or a really tanking economy. We don't have either of those here. Polling indicates that Sununu's up by about 10. And, you know, you mentioned the fundraising numbers, and Molly Kelly has outraised Chris Sununu 3-1 in the most recent reporting period. He does enter the final stretch of this race with a cash advantage, although for an incumbent with a nationally known name, he's a pretty bad fundraiser. He'll freely admit he doesn't like to do it. So, you know, he's got 400,000. She's got 200,000. You know, interest groups will add to that in terms of advertising. But this is a race that Democrats feel they have a chance to win if a blue wave eventuates, and they think that Molly Kelly by dint of her background, by dint of being a woman, is somebody who perhaps is best engineered to kind of ride a wave.
Speaking of nationally known names, Franco Ordonez, I wonder what your sense is of Senator Gillibrand making this trip to help Molly Kelly. Is there speculation about her future maybe in 2020?
There's a lot of speculation about her future in 2020. I think how much is it going to resonate is the big question. I mean, obviously, there's so many names being kicked around right now that, you know, I think time will tell, but there's no question that Gillibrand is one of the people that people are talking about and certainly are watching very closely. And every move that she makes is being picked apart, analyzed, and looking for how it could mean and how it could what impact it could have on 2020.
Lots to discuss with business and the economy this week, including the U.S. deficit. We don't hear much about it these days, but it's back in the news because the Treasury Department revealed this week that the deficit has grown. Last year, it was about $666 billion. Not a significant number there at all, $666 billion. This week, the Treasury Department revealed that the deficit has grown to $779 billion. It's a six-year high, and projections say it is on track by the end of this decade to hit $1 trillion, the deficit, $1 trillion. Now, Alexandra, some experts are pointing to the Trump administration for being responsible for this, particularly the tax bill. Part of the sales pitch for the tax bill, for the tax cut, is that by cutting taxes, business would kind of unleash more productivity, the economy would boom like never before, and the resulting largesse would more than make up for whatever we lost in tax revenue. How is that working out so far?
Well, we haven't seen that yet, certainly. And in fairness, Republicans are arguing that that's going to take, about a decade to even out. Though at this rate, although the economy is booming, there's no way that it can make up for where our deficit is at this point. It was sort of an open secret in Washington that the real plan that Republicans were kicking around was welfare reform to cut down on the deficit. And that conversation has started again on Capitol Hill. That obviously won't move forward until after the midterms, but there is conversation about, starting to work on a welfare reform bill that would cut some public benefits like Medicare, that kind of thing. And so going forward, it's interesting to hear or to see Republicans' silence on this issue when they, were previously the party of deficits, but it's also an opportunity for them politically to push another priority of the Republican Party, which, again, is welfare reform.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blamed the rising deficit on public assistance programs in an interview with Bloomberg News on Tuesday.
What's going on with the debt?
It's very disturbing, and it's driven by the three big entitlement programs that are very popular, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. That's 70% of what we spend every year. The subject we were just discussing, the funding of the government, is about 30% of what we spend. There's been a bipartisan reluctance to tackle entitlement changes because of the popularity of those programs. Hopefully, at some point here, we'll get serious about this. We haven't been yet.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking to Bloomberg News on Tuesday. Several of you have commented to us on the deficit, including Dean, who wrote, "The GOP, the party of Trump, has again shown the inability to care for poor, aged, and sick Americans. Those deficit hawks first pushed a false narrative that the tax cuts would pay for themselves. Then when the deficit continues to rise, they can only blame Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They don't care about anybody not wealthy enough to fund their campaigns. This is disturbing, disgusting, and dishonest, and they should be held to account." David emailed, "Ultimately, the economy will have the biggest impact on the midterms. The economy is the one issue that impacts people's daily lives. I think voters can overlook many of Trump's downfalls as long as they feel secure in their financial status." In business news this week, Uber and Lyft are getting closer to going public with what could be big windfalls for both of the world's leading rideshare companies. According to the Wall Street Journal, Uber's initial public offering could value the company as high as $120 billion. Meanwhile, Lyft has chosen JPMorgan Chase to handle its IPO. Its valuation is far smaller, about $15 billion. Bill Gates has long been the name and face associated with Microsoft, but the company was co-founded in 1975 by Gates and his childhood friend, Paul Allen. Allen was known for his philanthropy, for being a sports team owner. He owned the Portland Trailblazers and the Seattle Seahawks. Paul Allen died on Monday at the age of 65. Alexandra Jaffe, Paul Allen was one of those people that a few people really knew, both for owning the Seahawks and the Trailblazers, for his entrepreneurship, for his philanthropy. He gave more than $2 billion to charity over his lifetime. He made movies. He was a blues rock musician. It's kind of interesting, Alexandra, that he kind of never became the household name.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that was a purposeful sort of choice. You've seen a lot of CEOs get out there and raise themselves up as innovators. But this man lived a broad life, and he lived it on his own terms. I don't think he was the kind of man that needed that public attention. But to your point, he accomplished a lot in his long life.
Also worth noting in the business world that the retail giant Sears has filed for bankruptcy. It's just the latest move in a decline that's been going on for some decades now. Sears' chairman, Edward Lampert, argues that the company can turn around, but only by closing more stores and borrowing more money. In television, some beloved characters return to the air this week in a continuation of the sitcom Roseanne. The Conners picks up where the Roseanne reboot left off when its star, Roseanne Barr, was fired by ABC Entertainment for making very inflammatory comments on social media. The Conners features the rest of the cast dealing with the sudden death of the family matriarch, Roseanne Conner. Listen.
Wait, what? Mom overdosed?
It doesn't make any sense. I got her knees fixed. I flushed all her pills.
Oh, my God. I found these pills in Mom's closet.
Well, these aren't even prescribed to her. She got them from Marcy Bellinger.
Damn. That's the only thing from Mom's closet that I wanted.
Part of one of the new episodes of The Conners. Josh Rogers, I'm not sure how I feel about this. I watched the Roseanne reboot. It was very, very good. It was really well written before all of this craziness happened. I get the idea of dealing with the opioid epidemic and the family shock at seeing that Roseanne overdosed and not knowing about it. It also kind of feels like a very deus ex machina way to kind of like cut her off of the show. I don't know how I feel about this.
Well, I mean, it's a way to have somebody die that is relevant in the, you know, world that the show inhabits. I mean, you know, here in New Hampshire, I think 488 people died from drug overdoses last year. And, you know, in the milieu that the Conners is portraying, I mean, you know, opioids are a big issue. So.
And I think we should note, Franco, just briefly, that the show did get credit for being able to create a network hit that played in parts of the country that did go for President Trump in the election. It was supposed to be one of these shows that allowed the whole nation to deal with these issues very directly.
No, absolutely. It was one of those shows that people are like, hey, finally we have a show that represents, you know, a part of America that is so often ignored. It showed families who were obviously split about what was going on in Washington. They were unhappy about the fighting in Congress. They had, you know, polarized opinions about our president, President Trump. But at the same time, they fought through that and they still loved each other and they still had humor and they still, you know, needled each other in the ways that families do. There were a lot of talk about new shows coming up to try to match that. The problem that Roseanne had is that in her personal life, the real life Barr crossed so many moral lines.
There will soon be some big shoes to fill in children's television. Since 1969, one of the most famous roles on TV has been played by one man.
I'm happy to be me.
Yeah.
I don't want to change my looks, won't wear a wig. I'm a bird that's proud of being big. Take a look over here, and what do you see? I'm glad to be the way I am. So glad to be the way I am. I'm glad to be the way I am. So happy to be me.
Carol Spinney played Big Bird on Sesame Street and voiced Oscar the Grouch since the show started on TV 50 years ago. This week, Spinney announced his retirement from the show, sending several generations of fans into shock. He's retiring at the age of 84, but don't worry, Big Bird is not going away, nor is Oscar the Grouch. Oscar will be played by puppeteer Eric Jacobson. Spinney's apprentice, Matt Vogel, will take over for Big Bird. Sid wrote on our Facebook page, after nearly 50 years and 4,400 episodes, Carol Spinney retires from his roles as the lovable Big Bird and cranky Oscar the Grouch. It goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, a job well done. Thank you, Carol, for helping make the world a kinder, more gentle, and heartfelt place. We love you. We also thank the three of you for making the Friday News Roundup what it has been today, including Josh Rogers, senior political correspondent at New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Good to be with you.
Alexandra Jaffe, correspondent for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Thanks, Alexandra.
Great to be here.
And Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for McClatchy. Thanks, Franco.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Would you know if someone applied for credit using your Social Security number? If not, listen to Joe Whitchurch, head of the CreditWise app, talk about the new SSN tracker his team recently released.
While identity fraud is something everyone needs to be worried about, we want to make it easy and seamless for them to become aware of anybody attempting to use their identity without their knowledge or permission.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
The question no one has yet been able to answer is, where is Jamal Khashoggi? The BBC reports that Turkish officials believe his body may have been disposed of in a forest. Mr. Khashoggi was a U.S. resident and a columnist for The Washington Post. He disappeared after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd. Also, a setback for Afghanistan's fledgling democracy after the assassination of a powerful local police chief. Brexit hits the brakes, and reports suggest that Canada is running out of weed days after the country legalized marijuana. Joining us for this week to help us make sense of what's been going on around the world is Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor at the Pulitzer Center and a Washington columnist for the Boston Globe. Indira, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks, Joshua. Good to be
also,
here.
Good to have you with us. And also pleased to welcome back James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. James, welcome.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
And in New York, Hayes Brown, deputy world news editor at BuzzFeed News. Hayes, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be back.
The investigation continues into the possible murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. After visiting Saudi Arabia and Turkey this week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo advised President Trump to give the Saudis more time to finish their investigation into the disappearance. Khashoggi vanished more than 2 weeks ago after entering the Saudi consulate in Turkey. He's a Saudi national, but has a green card and is a U.S. resident. Now, Turkish police have claimed for weeks now that Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the consulate. On Wednesday, Turkey's government leaked information of what it claims is an audio recording of Khashoggi's last moments. This was released to the press in Turkey. Indira, let me start with you. Let's start with this tape. Do we have any idea of how valid the audio is or whether anyone has heard it? What context should we put this tape in right now?
Look, we personally have not heard it, but certainly Turkish reporters have been apparently leaked this tape, and a number of reporters as well in, international outlets like the New York Times seem to have had some access to intelligence officials who have heard the tape, as well as, I can't preclude that someone may have heard the tape themselves. Certainly, the Turkish officials from the very beginning seem to have had surveillance of their consulate, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, at which this happened. And there was no shortage of them feeding information to media about this. Now, on the one hand, of course, the Turks have their own reasons for wanting to, create trouble for the Saudis. At the same time, this appears to have been, if these recordings are valid, a completely gruesome, horrific murder. And even the president himself said yesterday it appears that he was murdered. There are reports that the Turks played for Secretary Pompeo this recording and gave him a transcript of it. And he refused to comment to the press on whether he had heard this alleged recording. But when he came back after meeting with President Trump, it was then that President Trump said he seems to be dead. And if the Saudis are indeed involved, there should be severe consequences.
Indira, before I move on from you, could you just clarify what you meant in terms of the Turkeys and the Saudis, the Turks and the Saudis, the drama there?
Sure. I mean, there is a long history of rivalry between Turkey and Saudi Arabia in the region in terms of supremacy and leadership of the Muslim world. And certainly Turkey and Saudi Arabia have been on different sides in some ways in the Syrian conflict. So there is some other rivalry that has nothing to do with Khashoggi. But that said, and also it's ironic because the Turks have certainly suppressed their own press and jailed. I think they have the record at this point for the most reporters who were held in jail. But this seems to have been even too much for them to take, apparently listening to this gruesome murder of this man having his fingers cut off, being decapitated and dismembered, is what the reports say.
Yeah, and I do take your point, Indira. I don't think anyone gives the government of President Erdogan too much credit for being what we would consider a First Amendment leader. He's been repressive in his own ways. But as you said, this is kind of another level of a situation going on in Turkey. Hayes Brown, let's go back to Secretary Pompeo's visit. I wonder how much we see, how much we think he accomplished while he was there. One of his key meetings, as I understand it, only lasted about 15 minutes. The other meeting was not that much longer when he went to visit Saudi Arabia. What does he come back having to show for those trips?
Publicly, not much, actually. He infamously, at this point, among foreign policy circles, said to the press as he was leaving Saudi Arabia that they didn't discuss facts. And that is absolutely baffling. Why did you go to Saudi Arabia, many are asking, if not to get facts about this case? I will say that the U.S. is in an interesting bind right now, considering the fact that decades of strategic policy in the Middle East has been built around the idea that Saudi Arabia is an ally, though they may have their human rights issues. That's something that we have to overlook in order to gain access to oil, to gain access to the regional strength that they have and their leadership. It's something that Trump has been arguing in trying to push back against the desire to actually do anything about this supposed murder. And it's something that I feel like the Trump administration is having more of a struggle with than other administrations would, even though they would grapple with it too. But given how enmeshed the president is still with his personal businesses, of which the Saudis have dumped quite a bit of money in recent years into his hotels and into his properties, this linking of these two things makes it hard to unravel what is in the strategic interest of the United States to say or not say about this case and what is in the president's personal interest.
We should note, Hayes, that earlier this week the president tweeted, quote, "For the record, I have no financial interests in Saudi Arabia, in parentheses, or Russia for that matter. Any suggestion that I have is just more fake news, all caps, parentheses, of which there is plenty," unquote. So, Hayes, that's not true?
I would say that's not true. In recent years, since he became president, the Saudis have spent a lot of money at his Washington, D.C. property, the Trump Hotel there. They bought apartments in his buildings in Trump Tower, I believe, in New York City. They bought an entire floor previously. He has sold a yacht to Saudi prince. He has had financial ties in the past, at least. And while he might not be making new business deals with the Saudis, the fact that he is still gaining profit from their staying in his D.C. hotel and other properties, that is a financial link.
I think loophole there, Joshua, is saying in Saudi Arabia. He may not have his own investments in Saudi Arabia, but he has plenty of business deals with Saudi Arabians.
Well, and those business connections might turn out to be something of an Achilles heel for the Saudis, depending on how they deal with this, James. I mean, there is more pressure mounting on Saudi Arabia to resolve this, particularly on this worldwide business summit that's scheduled for next week in Riyadh. A number of companies have dropped out, including Google and Uber and JP Morgan Chase. Ford's chairman said he's not going. A number of media companies like the New York Times and CNN. Yesterday, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin announced he would not be going. I wonder if this is kind of where the major pressure lands on Saudi Arabia, especially because the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been trying very hard to make Saudi Arabia look much more business friendly to the world.
You know, I think that whole campaign is at a standstill now, and I have a lot of questions of whether it's even sustainable going forward. Because you know, even before this, there was a lot of concern that MBS was a hothead. He's very reckless, very young. Yes, he's a reformer, but he's also become much more autocratic than his predecessors. He started this huge fight with Qatar. He is running this really reckless war in Yemen, where seems not to have a very strong sensitivity to civilian casualties. Started this big fight with Canada because he thought they had dissed him. This is the most egregious of a number of steps that suggests that this guy is going to be a very, very reckless ally to have, which creates a huge problem for the Trump administration, because as close as Saudi Arabia has been as an ally in the past, Jared Kushner has created a particular close relationship with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. Part of Jared's supposed peace deal, he was critical to that. They are critical. They just gave $100 million to our rebuilding effort in Syria. They are a part of the pushback against Iran that included the tearing up of the Iran nuclear deal. So the Trump administration got very, you know, close to this administration, and this administration is looking very, very dangerous.
Yeah, glad to get...
Just to jump in, especially when you consider the fact that Mohammed bin Salman is so young. He's in his early 30s. And previously that was said in the context of, oh, he's so progressive. Oh, he's going to be making a big positive change in Saudi Arabia for so long. But now we have to rethink, well, most Saudi leaders have been living to the age of 70, 80 years old. How long is he going to be in power if he is so reckless at this point?
There have been some questions about whether or not the power that he has might not be his for very long, depending on how he deals with this. Catherine wrote on our Facebook page, Putin denies Russia had anything to do with the poisoning of the former military officer and his daughter. Saudi prince denies any involvement in murder of journalists who criticized him. Trump goes along with both. Anyone else worried about the U.S. abandoning our moral authority? Sonia wrote on our Facebook page, here's what I don't understand. A Saudi national was grabbed in a Saudi embassy in Istanbul. It's been determined that Khashoggi was murdered based on recordings heard by no one but some Turkish government officials who want to remain anonymous. Turkey has not released the recordings, but there have been leaks of what's in them. Turkey's government's not above repression and this kind of nefarious behavior themselves. What exactly are we supposed to do as an uninvolved third party? Before I let you respond to that, Wajobu tweeted, an uninterested third party? Hardly. Khashoggi was a legal permanent U.S. resident with children who are U.S. citizens. The USA is an interested party, even if Trump is not interested. Indira, would you respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's right that we're not an uninvolved third party. This man was a resident. He was not only that, he was a columnist for a prominent American newspaper, The Washington Post. And let's be honest that a lot of the reason this has gotten so much attention in this country is because The Post has rightly put a huge and hot spotlight on it and not let anyone forget about it. And, you know, other newspapers in the United States and world media have picked up on it too and really kept the attention on it. I was struck by President Trump saying yesterday when he finally acknowledged that, yes, it appears this man was murdered, that he said this story has captured the world's imagination, unfortunately. And I thought, unfortunately, what's unfortunate about it? It is the job of the media to demand accountability, to seek truth. And our values as America, and as we've always been a global leader, we try to put ourselves forward as the leader of the free world. Part of that is about moral values. And when we have a very close ally who, by the way, our military hardware is used in that Saudi campaign in Yemen that has killed so many thousands of civilians and children and is now leading to a huge famine in Yemen, how can we say that we're an uninvolved party? You know, this is someone who was resident of our soil and working for one of our companies, and it's absolutely not true. When you have an ally who is alleged to have done something like this, we have certain forms of leverage that include arms sales, that include potential sanctions,
right,
and many other things.
I will say, though, James, I do kind of feel where Sonia's coming from in a way, because, and we've talked about this on this program before, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have had a long relationship, but we have never tried to exert strong moral or ethical pressure on Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's a very transactional relationship. And so just because one is uninvolved doesn't mean that one is unentangled, but I kind of take Sonia's point. Like, the U.S. doesn't really want to have to spank Saudi Arabia over its actions because there is a tremendous military and economic entanglement. So I'm not really sure what the U.S. has the power to do or if it has the moral authority to do it.
Well, this is let me amplify that point, Joshua, because it's absolutely critical. You know, someone who's been actually very good on this is Senator Marco Rubio, who made the point, and I'm paraphrasing here, that all the money in the world and all the military contracts in the world would not be enough to buy back our credibility on human rights if we don't stand up against something as fundamental as murdering journalists for their opinions. That's an international norm. There's a lot of other norms that were broken here, but that's a critical one. I mean, this show is called 1A for the First Amendment. That is in our DNA to stand up for a free press around the world. And if we don't stand up strongly against that, it'll be a very, very damaging precedent. And as Senator Rubio said, we'll never be able to buy our credibility back on these issues.
Senator Lindsey Graham made a very similar point. He was so angry and he said, I've been a huge ally of MBS in Saudi Arabia, but I'm never going there again as long as he's in power. He's outraged by it. So this is a bipartisan issue.
And Hayes, it is worth noting that the Washington Post this week, it published what is believed to be Jamal Khashoggi's final column. It's called What the Arab World Needs Most is Free Expression. It was published in English and in Arabic, and he writes about the systematic dismantling of the free press in much of the Arab world. Here's one brief quote from that column. Quote, these actions no longer carry the consequence of a backlash from the international community. Instead, these actions may trigger condemnation, quickly followed by silence. As a result, Arab governments have been given free rein to continue silencing the media at an increasing rate. Unquote. Hayes, what do you think? Is he right?
I think he is definitely right. So this has been, you know, one of the longstanding problems with U.S. foreign policy in the region is that oftentimes strategic interests have taken the front seat compared to human rights issues. Under the Obama administration, you had a lot of great words about how he actually did stand up to Saudi Arabia in word, but if not in deed. We never halted arms sales to Saudi Arabia despite the ongoing campaign in Yemen. We never threatened to sanction them over their funding of jihadists and other extremists in Syria. We never have really taken very strong action against Saudi Arabia or any country in the region for their actions, except for Iran, who has been fundamentally aligned against the Gulf states. So I completely agree with the sentiment in his column. If we haven't been willing to take action before, I hope that we have the fortitude to actually that members of Congress actually have the fortitude to actually pass some sort of legislation that does something if the Trump administration does not. But it seems unlikely given the history of the issue.
So basically, the people who killed Jamal Khashoggi may get away with this. That they we may never really know who killed him. There may never be any real prosecution because of just the cold, hard fact that the relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis is a business relationship.
And you totally see that when you look at the president's comments that it might have been rogue killers who took out Khashoggi and reporting earlier this week that said that the U.S. is actively working with the Saudi government to try and come up with some sort of feasible solution that admits the death of Khashoggi but does not blame Mohammed bin Salman.
Joshua, can I come in on that?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a point here that's important to make. I think the reason Pompeo went over to Saudi Arabia was to say that, look, you have to get out in front of this. This is you cannot sweep this under the rug. I'm absolutely convinced we're going to get to the bottom of this because there's just so much evidence that the Turks now have. They've photographed these 15 individuals who flew in, 12 of which are part of the Crown Prince's security detail or intelligence services. I think we're going to get to the bottom of this. Now, I also think there's going to be a fall guy that is somewhere just below the Crown Prince. There are already stories that maybe they're going to offer up his intelligence chief, yeah, General Ahmed al-Siri, as the scapegoat. So I think we will know who did this, and I think probably the Crown Prince will try to offer up a senior scapegoat. But I'm pretty convinced we're going to figure out what happened here.
Well, we will keep an eye on this story. We're glad to get some more of your comments on this. For now, let's move on to some of the other big stories that made news this week and may have flown under your radar because of all the attention about Jamal Khashoggi, rightly given, of course. But there's also an update from Afghanistan, where the war continues to rage 17 years after it began with no clear end in sight. Yesterday, the Taliban killed a leading police chief in Kandahar. The commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, General Austin Scott Miller, escaped unharmed. Today, the Afghan government announced it's delaying elections in that province. They were supposed to take place tomorrow. Those elections will carry on as planned in the rest of Afghanistan, despite widespread violence. The Taliban have already killed at least 10 candidates and scores of voters. Indira Lakshmanan, give us some sense of how the Taliban's efforts might affect the outcome of this election, voter turnout, the reliability of the results. What's the kind of upshot of all this?
Unfortunately, every election in Afghanistan has been marred by violence, so this is not unique. But the ability of the Taliban to take out this really legendary police chief in Kandahar, General Abdul Razik, and also his provincial intelligence chief is really stunning, and it appears to have been an inside job. Someone from his, essentially, his guard corps. It is striking that this happened. He's someone who was very hardline against the Taliban, who was a real ally for the United States in all these years, going on 17 years now since the U.S. has been involved over there. And one of the things that's really sad about this is that these parliamentary elections had already been delayed. You have more than 2,500 candidates who are running. On the sort of positive side, there are 400 women running this time, which is really an unprecedented number. Back in 2009, there were no women who could be found to run for office in some of the more conservative districts. That has dramatically changed, even though a lot of women have been threatened and attacked for running. But I think that, you know, these elections were meant to be a benchmark for how is Afghanistan doing 17 years since the fall of the Taliban, 16 years since Karzai came into power. And now, there's been several governments since. So it's very sad for the people of Kandahar and overall. And I think this is going to suppress voter turnout with fears of more violence.
Let's carry on with that attack yesterday. As we mentioned, the Taliban succeeded in killing the Kandahar province's police chief, General Abdul Razik, and its provincial intelligence chief, General Abdul Momin. The group missed its American target, General Austin Miller, but other Afghans and Americans were injured. Hayes, General Razik had survived dozens of attempts on his life until yesterday. Can you give us a sense of why these guys were targeted and what that means for the larger U.S. effort in Afghanistan?
Well, a large chunk of U.S. efforts against the Taliban in the last, nearly two decades has focused on Kandahar. Kandahar is a bit of a bellwether for the state of the stability of Afghanistan. And when you see the situation like what we have here, where it was a total decapitation of the leadership of the region, and that sends such a strong message to the people in the other regions of Afghanistan that if we can do this here, we can do this in your provinces as well. I mean, if we have a situation where all of the top officials are not safe from Taliban after this many years, then where are they safe? Where is their security in Afghanistan is the question that many will have after this.
James Kitfield, give it to me straight. We're nowhere near winning this war, ending this war, are we?
No, we're not. In fact, we had a stalemate, I would say, a year and a half ago when there was the first Trump surge. And we're now backsliding. They've got more territory. Helmand and Kandahar are no-go areas, basically. And I will say this. I mean, I was with General Miller like a week and a half ago at a NATO summit in Warsaw. And he was talking on background about the upcoming elections. If they had managed to kill a four-star general, something none of our enemies in these, long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have managed to do. And it was a very near thing. Three Americans were wounded in this attack. So that would have, I think, probably been the death knell for our willingness to stay in that country. So it's a very, very near thing. And, the best hope I think we can have now is we have a new envoy there who is trying to resurrect peace talks. But I don't see us winning this conflict.
And Indira, Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, just mentioning, you mentioned the new envoy. Well, unfortunately, the new envoy is not working too well with the Afghan president. It was reported just the other day that he met with the Taliban secretly in Qatar behind President Ghani's back. They did not let the Afghanistan government in on the talks with the Taliban, which does not, between that and the Kandahar attack, does not show a lot of support for the Afghan government in a very troubled time.
Wait a minute. Back up, Hayes. I want to make sure I understand what you just said. So this guy was supposed to be an envoy between the current Afghan government that's led by President Ashraf Ghani and the Taliban. He's supposed to be a go-between, right?
Sorry. It's American Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad, former UN ambassador. President Ghani of Afghanistan was concerned that the U.S. would go behind his back to speak with the Taliban, and that appears to have happened based on a Taliban statement. That's how President Ghani learned that the U.S. had met with the Taliban in Qatar.
So the Taliban put out a statement saying, hey, we met with the Americans, and
yes.
Afghanistan's president's like, oh, news to me.
Correct.
Was there ever any kind of an accounting from the U.S. to the Afghan government as to why America had this secret meeting?
So far, they have not commented about the meetings, nor would Mr. Khalilzad. So no, we have not had an explanation of how this actually occurred yet, to my knowledge, at least.
I know we have to pause in a little bit, and Indira, I don't want to end up in a rabbit hole. There's much more we want to discuss on the roundup, but I can only imagine what this means to families who have been part of this war effort, who went after the 9/11 terror attack, believing that this was a winnable war, and now 17 years later, after all the blood and treasure that we've invested, here we are.
Right. Well, the effort on the United States side to have some sort of peace talks with the Taliban is actually a long-standing thing that started under the Obama administration. And even under the Bush administration, there were efforts to try to reach out and figure out if there was some way to get the Taliban, you know, to sort of pull out of this ongoing war in Afghanistan. So efforts to talk in Qatar, there have been those before. Mm-hmm. They haven't gone very far. And, you know, Richard Holbrooke, the late Richard Holbrooke, who was the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan under Obama, did, you know, try to get a reconciliation process, is what they called it, going. But certainly, if it's true that Zalmay Khalilzad went secretly to talk to the Taliban in Qatar and did not let Ashraf Ghani, who, let's face it, lived in Washington for many years, is a former mm-hmm. World Bank official, has very deep ties to the United States, to not let our U.S. allied president in Afghanistan know about it, that does not bode well for the relationship either.
Before we pause, James, where does this go from here?
Well, we have these elections coming up, and I think we'll have to see what happens there. It will be, you know, it will not be a victory either way, but we'll see if Ghani's still around by the middle of next year. There's parliamentary elections this year and then presidential elections next year. We're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. But as I said, we're at something less than a stalemate now. I actually think part of the problem is we keep surging in Afghanistan and then pulling out and hoping that the Afghan forces can stand on their own. That's the strategy. Each time we pull out a little bit too prematurely and they are not able to stand on their own. I don't know if we have another surge in us, but if we don't, then this thing seems to me is going downhill.
Speaking of interminable conflicts, Brexit. The timeline for that has been pushed back somewhat. We'll get to that in just a moment as the Friday News Roundup continues. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
This week on Ask Me Another, we've got comedian Nick Kroll. He tells us about how his own experiences inspired his animated series, Big Mouth.
I got pants in seventh grade.
What does that mean?
That's right, you're Canadian. So that would be, I was trouser removed.
This and so much more on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
This week, some Americans were probably green with envy at our neighbors to the north. They were celebrating in Montreal this week because on Wednesday, Canada legalized recreational marijuana nationwide. It's only the second country in the world to do so. Uruguay was the first in 2013. Andrew tweeted, Canada legalizing weed was like California legalizing weed. Both were like a long relationship where you've been dating forever, but just now made it official. Hayes, how big a deal is this? And do you think this is the start of a global trend, something that has just kind of been understood for a long time and just hasn't been made official yet?
You know, that's a great question because I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that when you look at the way that decriminalizing drugs has gone in places like Portugal, but you compare that to things like the UN Office of Drugs and Crime still is very hard on marijuana and claims that, you know, marijuana is this evil. So it's really tough to tell, like, where the global feeling is on weed legalization. If you were to bring it up, say, at a meeting in the European Union's European Parliament, then I'm guessing you still would not have nearly a majority of people in favor, even in a place like the EU. So Canada, I don't know. It really depends on how it goes in terms of the government controlling the access to marijuana, which it is doing now, compared to, you know, it being a private business, that private but illegal business among many small dealers. It depends on how it affects the global drug trade and whether there's going to be any sort of shift in, you know, I'm sure that Canada's going to be putting, unlike the U.S., a lot of funding into studying the effects of this new policy, whether it causes a surge in traffic accidents, whether it causes a surge in hospitalization or medical effects. So it's going to be really interesting 10 years down the line to see what has happened in Canada.
Yeah, the CBC out of Ottawa has a story about how police there are increasing some of their surveillance efforts for intoxicated drivers to make sure that more drivers aren't driving stoned. It is, of course, worth noting that in this country, marijuana is considered the most illegal level of illegal drugs, a Schedule 1 narcotic. It's right up there with heroin, LSD, ecstasy, peyote, and methaqualone, the drugs that are deemed to have no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. There was a conference call this week with Todd Owen, who is an official with U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. Here's how he answered one question from a reporter.
Is it possible to be not let into the States by saying, yes, I did smoke a joint or I have smoked in the past?
Yes, admission of illegal drug use are grounds to be found inadmissible into the United States. So yes, that's possible.
That's Todd Owen of U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. Indira, give us a sense of what this might mean for the relationship between the U.S. and Canada along the border.
Well, it's one more complication when, you know, border issues have been one of the primary issues of the Trump presidency. They already had a very difficult negotiation in doing this NAFTA 2.0, which in the end turned out to just take elements from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was this updated trade deal that the Obama administration negotiated that the Trump administration pulled out of and then sort of pulled these TPP things, tacked them on to NAFTA and said it's NAFTA 2.0. But it hasn't been easy. There have been so many strains between the United States and Canada. And, you know, this people are saying that essentially this is a potential marijuana mess right now. So I think this could be an issue because we certainly do not have legalized marijuana across the United States. It's only on a state by state basis.
I wonder also, James, what other kind of unintended consequences there might be for this. I mean, Justin Trudeau now has to kind of own this, whether it's seen as a good move or a negative move. There remains the question as to what legalization at a national level might mean for Canada. On top of that, there are early reports that suggest that supplies are running low because cannabis takes time to cultivate to the point of being saleable, and there are long lines around the block, and things are running out. Supplies are running out. I wonder what kinds of additional unintended consequences we might keep an eye out for.
Well, you know, the Canadian Medical Association Journal called this an uncontrolled experiment, so we're gonna find out a lot of things about this. But I must admit that I'm not that surprised when you can walk into the major states of the United States like Colorado or California and there's dispensaries for recreational marijuana everywhere. I think this is a trend that's happening all over the United States, and it's gonna keep going because people are going to realize that there's a lot of money to be made when you tax marijuana, and the use is happening anyway, and putting these people in jail is probably not the best use of public funds. So I see it as part of a continuum. I think it was kind of inevitable that our progressive neighbors to the north were probably going to get a jump on us on this. But, you know, I just been struck by going around the country and seeing states where this is already happening, and everyone kind of shrugs. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, this doesn't seem, James, to have the kind of energy. I mean, it's not like the fight against prohibition, you know, where it was considered this major, like, this issue about liberty, and of course it helped spur the rise of organized crime. If you've never seen the Ken Burns documentary, what are you waiting for? Go see it. This feels very much like something that was just kind of a matter of time. Like, yeah, they legalized it. It was going to happen sooner or later.
That's my sense, too. Yeah, that is, the trend is pretty clear in this country and in Canada. Canada's had medical marijuana since 2001. It's very popular, so Trudeau is not out on a limb by endorsing this. So I think it's kind of inevitable.
Yeah, not one of the loudest, most aggressive social movements with regards to the legalization of cannabis. A much more impactful movement that has reverberated around the world is the Me Too movement, and we should talk about that before our time is up. This week, MJ Akbar, who is the Minister of State for External Affairs in India, left that post after more than a dozen women accused him of sexual assault and harassment. Also in India this week, there have been protests and violence met any woman trying to enter the Sabarimala temple in Kerala State in India. Groups of conservative Hindu men threw stones and attacked women and journalists who tried to get too close. Let's start with the story involving MJ Akbar. Hayes, how have we seen the Me Too movement play out in India? Is this just kind of the beginning of its effect on men in power?
I think so. It's interesting because the Me Too movement really kicked off here in the United States a year ago. And for a while, I know that our reporters at least were watching India and waiting and wondering when is it going to affect this culture where we were so sure that it would finally have an impact. And now, in recent weeks, it has finally like grabbed the country and shaken it. We've seen, and it's all started with one actress, one Bollywood actress coming forward, and just it's been a tidal wave of accusations since then. Women taking to Twitter and being unafraid to name their alleged abusers and assaulters by name, and just being really willing to step out and do what the Indian courts haven't done before, which is try to bring these men into account. And it's really interesting that MJ Akbar is one of the first to go, considering he had such a long run in the Indian journalism scene, and most of the women who came forward about him were fellow journalists, were fellow reporters. So I feel like that added a bit of credence to these allegations, and we'll see whether in the future the women who are, I guess, lower down in social status will finally start to be believed as well.
With regards to that protest at the Sabarimala temple in Kerala State, the BBC's James Clayton was there asking people why they were protesting. Here is what one man said.
No. Never.
Not allowed.
Here the media and the politicians are making this. They want to change our belief. They want to destroy our culture. They want to destroy our religion. That's the only thing behind this.
That's some of what the BBC's James Clayton was told in Kerala State outside the Sabarimala temple there. Indira, I wonder what your sense is of this protest, particularly what the gentleman said. It made it sound as if there's this external pressure from the media and politicians. They want to destroy our culture. They want to destroy our religion, he said.
Well, obviously, that's not true. It's the most obvious part of that is that Narendra Modi, who is the Prime Minister of India, is from a fairly far-right Hindu nationalist party. So he's clearly not trying to destroy the culture and the religion. This is a historic Supreme Court ruling that basically ordered that women should be allowed and have equal rights in this particular temple in Kerala that you're talking about. But it's not the first such court decision. It's actually the third case in India of court saying, and the other two, I think, were in Maharashtra State, where Bombay is, saying that women had to be allowed into temples. This is not, this is not like a hugely widespread practice. In India, most temples, at least in my experience traveling across India as a reporter, most temples do allow women in. But there are, some extremely conservative temples where they weren't, and the court said, no, you can't do that because of equal rights. This whole Me Too thing is really interesting. Just in the last few hours, two more Bollywood directors were embroiled in this. So as Hayes was saying, this is really spreading suddenly now in India. But I think it's really stunning that women at the lower levels, lower caste women, poorer women, rural women, are not getting the benefit that some of these, prominent journalists or prominent women in Bollywood are getting. There's a huge problem in India of sexual violence. And many of your listeners will remember several years ago the horrific case of the young student, a college student, who a physical therapy student, who was raped and murdered on a bus. And, you know, there are so many cases like this. Indian society has risen up and tried to do something about this. I hope that this will be a moment that the Indian women's movement can take advantage of and make some progress.
Let's talk Brexit for a moment. European leaders have dropped plans for a special summit next month to complete a deal that would see the UK leave the EU. This week, the head of the European Parliament said that Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, offered nothing new at Wednesday's summit, which was considered a make-or-break meeting. This decision to kick the can down the road left Mrs. May under attack from all sides.
We have a Prime Minister who is a Remainer, who has once again come to a European summit and humiliatingly agreed that she's prepared to sign up for a further year of transition. The problem isn't Brexit. The problem is the Prime Minister.
That was Nigel Farage, who was the leading Brexit campaigner. Each week, it seems like a deal is looking a little less likely, James. I mean, at what point does this become something to worry about?
Right now, I was in London as part of a reporting trip a week and a half ago, and they are transfixed by what looks like a cliff of hard Brexit. You know, part of May's problem is she's going and negotiating with the EU, and her own party is split on this. You heard Nigel Farage; he's a hard Brexit type. He just wants to let the deal expire next spring, and see what happens. Basically, a lot of people in the business community think this is extremely reckless. May's idea is a soft Brexit, if you will, that was agreed on at Chequers, but her own party is split on that, and it's not clear that the Labour Party is going to give her much help. So she's in a very tenuous position, and you mentioned kick the can down the road, which we've been doing for a year and a half on this. The road is about to disappear next spring, and there is a lot of concern. And basically, Britain right now is so inward-looking and transfixed about this sort of slow-motion train wreck that it can barely think about anything else.
But the EU and the European Council President Donald Tusk, the Pole, has actually said that EU leaders are going to be willing to have an extension beyond this 21-month transition period. She apparently went to Brussels and begged them and literally said in this 15-minute nervous appeal, I need help. I need help from you in the EU getting this through Westminster, getting it through the British Parliament.
Right.
So they're apparently very open to giving more time for a negotiated solution.
A few of your comments on Brexit. Peter wrote on our website, the1a.org, British politicians keep kicking the can down the road, which may turn out to be a cul-de-sac. And Susan wrote on our website, Brexit is such a mess. It's what happens when many people vote and then go looking to see what they voted for. Mm-hmm. One of the people who's upset about this and wants to remain in the EU is a wealthy London plumber. Charlie Mullins put a big, rather controversial billboard above his office that's got some people talking. Here's Charlie speaking to Andrew Castle on LBC Radio.
The sign in very, very large letters, which everyone can see on the train into Waterloo, says bollocks to Brexit. What reason have they given for you to take that down, Charlie?
I feel that we're being bullied into leaving the EU, and now we're aware of what's going on and what we're letting ourselves in for. I don't think businesses or anybody should stand by and allow anybody to destroy our business, our country, and our livelihoods for children and grandchildren.
That's Charlie Mullen speaking to Andrew Castle on LBC Radio. Hayes, I wonder if that's kind of the crux of the Brexit story right now, that you've got all these Brits who voted for Brexit and are now looking around going, oh my God, what did we vote for? How is this going to work?
It's very true, because that was how a lot of people felt the day after Brexit. People who cast their vote thinking, oh, my vote's not going to matter. It's going to fail. We're going to remain in the EU. But I get to register that I am angry about the fact that those horrible Europeans over there on the continent are making rules for me. But now they're realizing, oh, this is actually a problem. It's like a sped up version of the climate change debate almost, where people were telling them, no, this is bad, this is going to be very bad, but they still went along with the delusion anyway that it's going to all be fine.
Also worth noting that this weekend, millions of people are expected to take part in a march for what they're calling the People's Vote, which would be a chance for another vote on the deal. One more story before we go, like a little case of when marketing goes wrong. Coca-Cola got itself into a bit of a bilingual bungle in New Zealand. The company tried to appeal to the Maori people in New Zealand by writing the phrase, "Kia ora, mate," on a vending machine. Kia ora is a common phrase for New Zealanders. It means be well. It's kind of like saying aloha, like a general hello or a hi. Mate means friend. But if you're reading it in Maori, mate, M-A-T-E, is mate. And mate in Maori means death. So the vending machine sign in Maori reads, "Hi, death." Oh. Cue Twitter and people pondering if Coke had finally become self-aware and was engaging in a little truth in advertising. Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor at the Pulitzer Center and a Washington columnist for the Boston Globe. I'm going to go have a tall glass of water on that note. Indira, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Joshua.
James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Thanks, James.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Hayes Brown, deputy world news editor at BuzzFeed News. Hayes, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks also to the team here at New Hampshire Public Radio, a fantastic station. You'll find more of their excellent reporting, including their coverage of how New Hampshire is covering these primary elections and what voters here are interested in, online at nhpr.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.